Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. Alina's gone and found something a little bit different for us today. Alina, what have you found?
I have gone and found you a major. He's still a major. Are you still a major at the moment?
I think you say major retired.
I'm avoiding all of that. I'm just going with Mr. these days. I think that works. That works rather
Okay.
nicely.
Okay. So we've got with us Mr. Andrew Fox, who served in the British Army for 16 years, first in the Royal Welsh and then in the Parachute Regiment. He served on three tours of Afghanistan between 2007 and 2010, and one of Bosnia in 2018. He retired early this year as Major and is now a PhD student and War Studies lecturer at the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst. Hi, Andrew. Welcome on the podcast. We finally got you on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. I was quite flattered, so I'm really grateful for the invitation.
God, what an overachiever, though. You're making us look
I
bad.
think of it more as being just a closet nerd for 16 years, and now I can be an
Now
out and
you're
proud
fully
nerd.
able. But
No,
before you
yeah.
go fully into nerddom and disappear down the war ball route with us, we do badges, by the way. We're going to talk to you about your time in Afghanistan and with the Royal Welsh and with the paras, aren't we?
Yeah, that's the plan, as I understand
Yeah, brilliant. He's like, at least I hope
it.
that's what we're going to talk about.
Doing some oral history for we have not done oral history in a while, and I'm really looking forward to this.
This is going to be good. So let's start with the beginning, I guess, which makes sense all round. In 2007, you were a platoon commander attached to the Mercians with the Royal Welsh. It was also your first tour of duty, and you were sent to Afghanistan. Let's talk about this tour because you went there straight from training, didn't you? How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean the Herrick 6 rotation was on, and it was the very first time the army had pushed a full brigade out there, I think. They'd given the paras the first shot, who went kind of with three para battle group plus a bit of a brigade headquarters. So it was quite a small number of troops. And that winter, I know the Royal Marines had taken on their share of the work for a 6 month rotation, and then they kind of realised it was going to be a much longer enduring campaign, and so they sort of broadened it to the field army from rather than just the spearhead troops. And the first, this tour was kind of the first rotation that the sort of the remainder of the army had deployed on. And basically all of us who had units that were out there kind of got summoned into the OC's office, the officer commanding, who was running the training course at Brecon. We were having quite a sedate time just learning how to plan ranges and stuff. We'd done the hard bit by then. And they said, "Oh yeah, all of you're off to Afghanistan. Best of luck," kind of thing. So that was kind of a shock. And then we went to do our pre-deployment training, which back then was, I think it was only a week. It was really, really short. And it was very kind of generic. It was very, very different to the kind of fully worked up pre-deployment training package you get in later tours. They were doing section attacks that were being done by Royal Engineer bandsmen as demonstration troops. So you had these sort of non-full-time soldiers, musicians showing us how to do section attacks, and we'd all just finished our infantry training. It was kind of a little bit turned on its head. But yeah, I kind of my company, my Royal Welsh company, had just done 6 months out there, and I think my OC was keen for me to have a bit of experience and a bit of credibility with the blokes. So he kind of pulled strings with his brother, who was over at Two Mercians, the commanding officer, and suddenly I found myself in Kandahar, like two tops, maybe 3 weeks out of training. It was pretty much every young platoon commander's dream, actually. I tell that to the officer cadets I'm teaching at the moment, and they all look quite jealous.
You mentioned just now that people who are playing in the orchestra were basically training you. Did I mishear that, or am I just going
Yeah.
crazy?
So they were the demonstration troops. So it's literally, this is how you do a section attack. And it was down at Lydd Camp on a sort of small patch of grass, probably no bigger than my garden. And you had eight professional musicians demonstrating a section attack to a bunch of newly qualified professional infantrymen. It was just, yeah, quite surreal. And kind of the officers there got around the private soldiers straight away and just went, "Right, forget everything you've just seen for the last half an hour. That is not how it's done, as you know."
Brilliant. So talk us through the tour. Did you have to find your own way to Camp Bastion?
Yeah, it was really random. So I turned up, we landed in Kandahar, and the plane did that really cool descent, and you kind of you're flying in normal, and then all of a sudden the lights go out, you put your body armor and helmet on, and the plane just drops, to try and avoid any anti-aircraft missiles and stuff. And you sort of, it's like a roller coaster where you then land and you get out of Kandahar, and most people know what they're doing and where they're going. And I was sort of stood there in the arrivals bit, with absolutely no idea where I was going and no one to meet me. So I had to find my way to kind of the Royal Welsh. So I had my Bergen, my grip, my day sack all kind of strapped onto my body. And I had to wander around Kandahar at 2 a.m. trying to find my unit, who then bundled me on a plane to Bastion the next day. I arrived in Camp Bastion after a little journey. And again, nobody was really expecting me or anything. So they kind of, and then I had to kind of find my own way to Camp Price, which is where the rest of the battle group were. So forward operating base Price is up in Goresk. And I happened to run into the Czech special operations group in the dinner hall, who mentioned they were going to Price the next morning. And I kind of went, well, do you mind if I jump in, please, lads? And they were like, yeah, sure. And they were these great massive blokes with beards and bandanas. And yeah, they were quite rogue. They were kind of a blend between special forces and sort of paramilitary police. And yeah, they drove around, and their method of trying to find the IEDs was to send a bloke on a quad bike at the front of the convoy. And if he went bang, then that was very unlucky. But it meant nobody else did. Yeah, it was completely random. And then I sort of rocked up at Price and found the battle group, and away we went.
This is very well organised. It's just going in my head. Perfect organiser. Exactly what you want to be doing.
Do you know what's hilarious, Alina, is this is all... You know, we interviewed Cam, who was a colonel in the RLC.
Like, yeah.
Basically, he should have been the one doing the organising, shouldn't he?
So basically, blame him. It's his fault that Andrew hasn't been able to get to the camp correctly. It's all
you know
his
he'll
fault.
Blame it on the RAF.
I'll drop him an email. I'll drop him an email and thank him, because actually it was really good fun.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't really often get to freestyle your way around a war zone. So, you know, it's kind of unusual experiences that kind of were a little bit different from the norm. And I quite enjoyed it, if I'm honest.
So there's another thing you've mentioned. So, oh God, I still can't pronounce this to this day. And you're going to laugh at me. So it's Operation... You're going to have to say this for me.
Yeah, Palkwahel, which is Hammer Blow in Pashto.
Okay, that's a much easier way. So can I just call it Operation of Hammer Blow? Is that going to just be easier for me? Okay.
Let's make it simple here.
Make it simple and easy. So Operation Hammer Blow, talk us through that, because that was the moment you got to see some actual action.
Yeah, and it was, you know, when I turned up at Price, they'd already done battle group orders for this and everything. So kind of I just zeroed my rifle and got a quick back brief on the plan from the company commander I was working with, and then away we went. So we kind of leaguered up in the deserts in the green zone overnight, and then the next day the plan was to go into an area called the Witch's Hat, which is in sort of the lower Goresk valley, and I think the paras and the marines had both sort of had quite a rough time there because they'd gone in quite small strength, so the Mercians were going in full battle group mode, and actually it was the first ever action of the Mercian regiment, because they deployed on tour as the Worcester and Sherwood Foresters, and they'd been amalgamated with the Staffords and the Cheshires halfway through the tour, so they'd done a cap badge change in Afghanistan. And really, it was kind of what we call combined arms. It was in action. It was fascinating to watch from a kind of a new boy's perspective, because, you know, we had fast air dropping 500-pounders, we had Apaches overhead, we had warriors giving fire support, we had Royal Marines in Viking armoured fighting vehicles, like they're like kind of twin cab things with tracks. You know, they kind of provided home bank protection, and the Royal Engineers put in an infantry assault bridge. And it was all very exciting, if I'm honest. You know, it properly felt like you were in a war rather than a counterinsurgency campaign or anything like that. You know, they didn't pull anything in terms of the punch. It was a real full-on kind of British Army flexing its muscles, which I've never seen before or since, if I'm honest. So it was really interesting and like tremendously exciting.
So talk to us about the canal that was in Taliban hands.
Yeah, so the way the sort of the Helmand's kind of that part of Helmand goes is you've got the river, and then either side you've got a bit of greenery that they use, you know, the bit of the land they can irrigate using the river. And then I think sometime in the 50s, the Americans paid for a big canal network, and that effectively gives you kind of left and right of arc. If you think of the river flowing north to south and then you come a little bit east, you've got a canal, and in the middle of that is the green zone. So, you know, we went over that, and the bridge was kind of shaky, and we were taking quite a bit of fire, as I remember. I ran over the bridge, and I forgot that the drop on the other side was about 6 foot. So I came over the end of the bridge, fell 6 foot, and lay there completely winded, whilst pretty much everyone on the far side that had already crossed was turned and laughing at me. So that was quite quite entertaining. And then later in the day, the bridge actually collapsed with two blokes on it. Fortunately, they were both okay. And but it did require the military divers to come out and get their weapons back from the riverbed. So, you know, it was quite a flimsy structure. But yeah, it was kind of sobering as well, because it was all very exciting until we dropped a 500 pounder, and unfortunately the Taliban had been using human shields, and I believe a family was killed. And you know, as we went over the rubble of that, you could see scraps of clothing and stuff, and it was all pretty. It was kind of a really fast step change from the excitement of kind of doing it all properly for real for the first time, to kind of an immediate lesson in the human cost of collateral damage and things like that. So it was kind of a really fast wake up call, and it was, you know, that day just went by in a blur, because you know, any one of those things would be enough to make you go, this is crazy, but to get, you know, all those things at the same time was pretty kind of, yeah, I think head wise it put you into a kind of almost shocked state, because it was so kind of so much overwhelming emotion coming your way in such a short space of time.
Did you have light-hearted moments too?
I mean, yeah, there's always comedy things, you know, in war. I mean, I was the Claymore guy, because I was straight out of training, so I was freshest on how to handle a Claymore. And we came into a compound and we were going to set up for the night, and I went out with a little fire team of soldiers to give me a bit of protection while I set the Claymore up. And it's not something you want to play around with, because if you get it wrong and it goes bang, then you know that's you. Even if you're not in front of it, it's still gonna cause a bit of damage when it goes off. So you're very carefully putting the fuses in, you know, tightening the fuses up, having already made sure the detonation clacker, as we call it, is working. And so this is all beautifully set up carefully. My protection were there. I called one lad, Fred, back towards me to start collapsing the protection, and he just walked backwards straight over the Claymore, tripped over it, fell on top of me, crushed me. So we had half a second of, sort of looking at each other going, holy shit, is this going to go bang? And fortunately it didn't, and then it became a funny story rather than a really, really awful one. So you know, that was kind of interesting. But yeah, you get all kinds of weird little things like that.
When you mentioned the Taliban using human shield, that is, I mean, it's awful in a physical and moral way, but also in a psychological way as well. For you, it must have been awful to know that by engaging them, they would be willing to do that. Are they psychological in outlook like that? Do they do more stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, the very nature of their tactics are quite psychological, because, you know, they'd have, you know, over a year now of losing to us in firefights. Yeah. You know, mano a mano, they didn't have the technology or the firepower to compete with us. And so they started putting IEDs in the ground. And, you know, the real, just the threat of them alone, if you can imagine patrolling, knowing that there's a chance something might go bang under your foot and you know nothing about it. You know, that's the strain that places on you every time you leave base. It's you know, it's horrendous. And on my later tours, I remember seeing, you know, lads from the Rifles up in Sangin when I was up there with the Americans, and I think we'll talk about that in a bit. But, you know, these lads are thrown up with fear every time they left the base, because they knew something was going to happen to them that's kind of outside their control. Because in a firefight, you've got control. You know, you can lay down a base of fire. You know you've got machine guns you can call for. And if it goes really, really badly, you can call for a fast air, or you can call for an Apache to back you up. Whereas when there's just this lurking death hidden in the ground, just waiting for you to stumble over it, you know, that's a profoundly straining experience. They used to do other things, like they'd howl at night. So they'd kind of creep up to the compounds we were in at night and howl like wolves. And it was just, you know, they were trying to psychologically intimidate you. And the howling was kind of effective. It was a bit spine chilling the first time you heard it, because, you know, you didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
And it often presaged an attack as well. So, you know, they often quite gave away their element of surprise to try and gain an element of psychological advantage.
That's what they do in Greyhound, isn't it? The wolf pack, they're doing submarines.
Yeah, no, it's very similar. They kind of stopped doing it after a while. But I think also you got to remember, they'd just taken a big loss. I mean, we had taken all the area of ground that we wanted to. And so I guess they felt the need to try and reestablish some kind of dominance, or some kind of at least score some points on the day. So you can see why they would do it. But yeah, again, if they launched a small arms attack on one of our compounds, they were never going to get anywhere, because you know, we had all our machine guns up on the sentry towers and things like that. So, you know,
I guess more than anything.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, the tactics they turned to certainly were very effective, I think, in creating that psychological effect in the British side of things.
There's one thing we have forgotten to talk about, and it's something that you brought up when we were having our chat. Tell us, where were you living?
So you kind of, on that operation, we had day sacks only, and I didn't see my Bergen the whole time I was out in the field. So we'd moved from compound to compound. And we ended up in this kind of, it was like the Afghan equivalent of Ludlow Castle, is all I can describe it as. It was really surreal for me because I grew up in Shropshire, which is obviously it was quite a pivotal county in the Middle Ages, and there's castles everywhere and ruins all over the place. And, you know, we rocked up at this fort in a place called Carder Calais, and it was honestly, you know, it had towers, it had a garderobe, everything you'd associate with a British castle, it was there, except there was walls made of mud and an enormous field of cannabis next door, which kind of pumped out that odour every morning. So it was like an Afghan mud castle for stoners. So I'd describe it, but it was very, very strange.
Did you get the throne room?
No, but we did make our own throne. We had pioneers with us. And instead of the usual Afghan toilet facilities, they made this beautiful construction out of an oil barrel and a tyre to sit on for a toilet seat. So, you know, we had very much the best throne in Afghanistan for that period of time we were in there. It's quite a luxury.
I wasn't thinking of that kind of thing. I've not had enough dealing talking to British soldiers. Tell us about, because we had a fair amount in the news and things about friendly fire, didn't we, during this campaign. Tell us about the Mercians and the anti-tank missile.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a sad thing, and, you know, it is out there in the media, so I'm not going to name any names or any units, or, you know, subunits particularly, but we were giving fire support to the Danes who were on the other side of the river in a compound called Alpha X-ray, and we were quite successful in, so the river was what was termed a no-fire line, so for safety reasons, you know, you call it battle space architecture, where you lay down things like you don't fire across this line so that you minimise your chance of hitting a friendly call sign. Mm-hmm. But occasionally we were able to get on the net when we had a really clear opportunity to open fire. And on one occasion, one of the other companies slightly further around fired a Javelin missile at Taliban who were attacking the Danes. But we were sort of sat there with a 90-degree on view of this. And you could just see the missile going from right to left. And you could see that it was going to overshoot. And it ended up impacting the Danish compound, unfortunately. So we were kind of just sat there, shocked and numb, and, you know, trying to find out what the hell had happened. And then, of course, the Kazovac Chinook turns up, and it's all incredibly tragic and awful. But it's so easy to do. And that's why they impose things like no fire lines. You know, I don't know what the outcome of the inquest was. And I've kind of deliberately steered away from it because it was quite an upsetting thing. I know that the chain of command who were involved with that and the soldier who fired the missile would have had a very rough time off the back of that. So, but yeah, it was just one of those really sad, tragic things that happens in war. And, you know, bottom line is, if you're going to throw around expensive missiles, you know, things are going to go wrong occasionally. And, you know, I've seen that a few times, you know, even with the 500-pounder, you know, at the start of the operation when the Afghan family was in the building when it hit. You know, I'm teaching Clausewitz at the moment. He talks about friction and sort of the chaos that's an inherent part of the character of warfare. And this is just a classic example of that, really. Just, you know, human beings make mistakes. And sometimes those mistakes have incredibly tragic outcomes.
You didn't end up having to deal with any wounded on this tour, did you? I mean, we are going to come back to this at another point. But on this specific tour, you didn't have to deal with any of them.
No, we were very lucky in my company. We didn't have any casualties on that one. We had anniversaries of guys who'd been wounded earlier on the tour. And I know on Palco Hill, we did lose a couple of our resupply guys who ended up in the canal in their vehicle, unfortunately. But yeah, we were really lucky. We didn't have, you know, we didn't have casualties for that one. So yeah, thank God for that.
You did a second tour in summer 2008, where you were a platoon leader slash Lieutenant. But we're going to move on to your third tour, which is winter 2009-10, where you were a liaison officer slash captain. So let's talk about this tour, because it was this is the most interesting of them, wasn't it? So tell us about the US Army 7th Group.
Yeah, I mean, I was really lucky. I was in a position where my Royal Welsh company had been folded down. They were only going to deploy with two companies, and mine was the one that got chopped. So they had a spare captain. So they sent me out ahead of the rest of the battle group to be the liaison officer for the brigade in Lashkargah, which wasn't particularly exciting. And I was pretty underwhelmed because, you know, I was already suffering some PTSD effects at this point, and all I wanted to do was get back and get some adrenaline and, you know, carry on fighting, as it were. So I was fairly underwhelmed by the job I'd been given. So I went out there, but then they put a delay on the Royal Welsh deploying. So they didn't deploy till Christmas time, I think. And I was already out there by September. And so Brigade needed someone to go off with the USSF, the Special Forces. And I was kind of like the spare bloke lying around with nothing to do. It was right time, right place. And off I went to go in and bed with the Green Berets, which is really cool. Because, you know, I turned up and the first thing the company commander said to me was like, "Hey, man, you know, are you coming out on the ground with us?" And I was like, I did not even know that was an option. Yes, I am. Absolutely. So I was delighted, and I got issued my American M4 carbine and sort of the cool radio, the M-Biter radio that they carry, and I got a quick training on that. And then basically my job was effectively pimping them out to the British. So I'd ring up the ground-holding battle groups. I'd ring up their intelligence officer and say, "Look, I've got an SF team here. Is there anyone that you want us to go and have a conversation with?" And they'd send me over the target packs, and, you know, away we'd go. We'd get our own. They had their own Scan Eagle, which was a kind of UAV. We do our own intelligence soak on the target. We could call on some other kind of cool assets to kind of get eyes on. And then we'd jump in our helicopters with the Afghan National Army commandos that we were training, go do the strike mission, see how that went. And then we'd come back for steak in the cookhouse and wait for the next target to come in. So it was a really dynamic tour. And, you know, I had loads of really interesting work to do. And then I got to go on the missions as well. So, you know, it was definitely a military career high point for me.
I mean, I asked you previously about two of the missions. So if we start with the first one, so this mission was in Kayakisofla.
Yeah, Kayakisofla, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, talk us through this mission and what happened.
I mean, anyone who served in Northern Helmand will know that village. It was renowned as a sort of a hotbed of unpleasantness. And it was a really interesting mission because it was against an IED facilitator. And when we took down the compound, the room that we found quite a bit of the IED components and stuff in, they'd whitewashed the inside wall, and they'd written up instructions on how to make IEDs on it. So they'd made a whiteboard on the inside of the compound. But what was really interesting is that a lot of the instructions on there were in English. So that was kind of an interesting bit of intelligence. But yeah, that mission turned quite cheeky. We took a lot of incoming fire. We ended up using some of the assets in the sky we had. You know, the Spectre gunship was called in, and you know, it was all fairly kinetic. And and we did take one, I think three casualties total for that mission. But I was given first aid to one of them. You know, unfortunately, he didn't make it. One of the Afghans. You know, I finished that mission covered in blood, and it was so strange because I got back to Bastion and my uniform was just, you know, written off from the blood. And I kind of got changed and sort of went to the cookhouse and saw the Royal Welsh lads who had now, by that time, had deployed. And, you know, it was so weird having to just, I didn't feel I could talk about it to them or kind of share what I'd just done. And there I was having a meal with my mates as if nothing had happened. And it was just the most weird disconnect.
Was there a lot of cooperation with Afghans?
Yeah, so the Green Berets are mentors. So we had an ANA company of their commandos, which is their SF, and we were responsible for training them and then taking them on the missions. You know, they planned themselves. They were very, very effective at doing mission planning. You know, I saw stuff from them that was just as good as any British stuff I'd done. They were really, really quality unit to work with.
The other mission Aline is referring to is Kandahar, and it involves a woman turning informer, doesn't it?
Yeah, this was quite an unusual one. So we entered the compound and secured a bunch of people. And there was kind of a field within the compound. It was kind of a big double wall thing where they obviously grew some crops. And we had the men separated and just on their knees. And we were trying to work out who was who and who was, you know, friendly, who wasn't. And we found a room where all the women in that compound had been kind of concentrated when they heard us coming in. And this Afghan old lady, she's very wizened, sort of came out and was just like, bah, giving it, you know, shouting at the American commander in Pashto. Got the translator over and basically she was saying that the Taliban had come there about 3 days previously and they'd effectively hold her and all her family hostage. At which point she promptly marched over to the field where all the men were being held and just went, he's Taliban, that's my brother, he's Taliban, that's my nephew, and kind of just absolutely bubbled all of them to us. So, you know, it was a good bit of human intelligence there. So obviously we nicked the ones that she identified and off we went.
Never piss off granny is the theme there, isn't it?
No, I've never seen someone so angry and so keen to help us. It was definitely unusual because you never really saw the women in Afghanistan because they were behind, you know, their religious dress. You get a flash of their eyes occasionally, but you very, very seldom even talk to them because you didn't want to upset the male Afghans that were there, and they've got very strict rules about what women can and can't do. So that was one of the one times I've seen an Afghan woman without her religious face covering on, and she was amazingly helpful. So that was great.
Sorry, I wanted to ask something. Because so far we've been talking about some pretty dark things on this tour.
Yeah.
I want to know about something positive that came with you on this tour, like something to do with the Americans. I mean, we love hearing American stories. As like the one the podcast Alex mentioned earlier that we did, with the kind of communication between the Americans was amusing.
Yeah, I mean, I think they found me an absolute curio because whilst I was technically a captain, I wasn't in their chain of command. They found my accent most entertaining and they nicknamed me Nigel because apparently all British men are called Nigel. I'm not entirely sure whether, I think they've watched Spinal Tap one too many times maybe. But they used to kind of like showing off a little bit. So when we were in Kandahar, some of the Green Berets were getting up to mischief with some of the American logistics girls and they had one of the Green Berets had coupled up with one of his fellow soldiers and he was taking his mate on a double date to meet her friend to see if they got along just as well. And for some reason, I'll never know, they took me along as well as a kind of observer. So we're in the Dutch cafe in Kandahar and, you know, the small talk starting. And so the Green Beret guy is asking this girl questions. And he's like, you know, he goes, so what do you do? And she said, like, oh, nothing. You know, I just deliver stuff. I'm in logistics. It's all very boring. And he goes, and he put on this ridiculous voice. And he was like, you know what? I deliver stuff too. And then he paused and looked down. I looked up again. And he goes, dead bodies. And honestly, it was the most cheesy thing I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, my God. Oh, tell me she did not buy that.
Oh, she did. She totally went for it.
Oh, no.
But on the flip side, I was at the end of under the table having to bite my knuckles not to wet myself laughing. So, it gave me a good laugh anyway. So, but absolutely stinking chat.
You have mentioned a couple of times already your PTSD, and it's something that you feel really passionate about talking about and helping other military personnel that are in the same position as you. I think the incident where you lost that guy you were telling us about sort of cemented your mental state. You didn't follow procedure in decompression, did you? What was Camp Bloodhound and what was it for?
So that's where usually where you go through in Cyprus. So you normally go and decompress for I think it's nearly a week. I mean, I've never done it, so I can't just tell you exactly from firsthand how many days it is, but I think it's about 5 days to a week where you basically drink beer and do water sports and hang out with your mates that you've just been, you know, in the shit with for 6 months, and it kind of just gets that out of the system before you then return to your family life, because the Americans, I think, have discovered, you know, I had American friends who'd be back with their families within 24 hours of being on a mission in Afghanistan, which, you know, you can imagine that jerk of being pulled out of a war zone and ending up suddenly back in domestic life when you've been away for 6 months to a year. You know, that's quite a jolt to the psyche, as it were. But because on all my three tours, I was kind of with other units other than my own, and I never really ended up going through decompression. So when I landed with the Mercians after my first tour, they kind of went left to decompress, and I just went back to the officer's mess in Cyprus where my unit were based. And I ended up at Paphos at like 4 a.m, naked in a bush with a bottle of vodka in my hand, which is certainly not the most healthy and well-recommended way to get over being in a war zone. Second tour, I don't think we did anything. And then third tour, again, because I wasn't serving with the unit, I left it a couple of weeks before then, before the rest of them. And so I ended up, again, just skipping decompression completely, which, you know, in hindsight, that put me at quite high risk. But, you know, it wasn't as well known about or as talked about as it is now. So the fact that I had a number of kind of high risk factors didn't really occur to me or anyone else, frankly.
I mean, we are going to talk about PTSD a bit more because it does involve one of the questions at the end. But before we move on to that, I want to talk about becoming a paratrooper, because you switched from becoming infantry to becoming a paratrooper in 2013. I mean, I'm really interested in how it was going from being a light infantryman to airborne infantry. So why did you switch, and how did you go through this training process?
So I'd seen the paras on Herrick 8 in summer 2008. You know, they three para were kind of the region battle group. So they'd rock up in your area of operations, do an operation, and then go off somewhere else. And I was impressed by seeing them. And by the way, that brigade worked. And then I got posted into 16 Air Assault Brigade as a captain in 2011. So I'd done 2 years in the brigade. And I just really liked it. I loved the ethos, that kind of the airborne ethos where, you know, you're encouraged to be independent. You're encouraged to have those incredibly high standards, and you know, all that sort of thing really appealed to me. And also working with the para battalions, you know, I really liked those soldiers. I mean, not that I didn't like the Royal Welsh ones, but you know, the para ones were, you know, they were a cut above. They were fitter, they were more determined, they were kind of a lot more cheeky and a lot more independent thinking. And you know, they had that pride in their beret and their wings, and it was just something that really appealed to me. And so as I left that staff posting in 16 Brigade, I put my transfer paper in, and they kind of knew me as well. So my boss, my two bosses, the brigade commander and the deputy commander, were both para-reg, and you know, they obviously had written me a fairly decent report, and the transfer process was pretty slick. You know, I'd also done P Company, which is the airborne selection, and I was pretty old at this point. I was 33, which meant competing with 18, 19 year olds on very fast runs was quite emotional. You know, the first mile on the first day of P Company is run at 5:45 pace, which is you're basically sprinting for a mile. And then you have a pain station where you do all kinds of calisthenics, and then you sprint that mile again, and you do that another 6 times, I think. So, you know, that's just day one.
I'll get
whereas,
that.
You know, yeah, whereas the 18, 19 year olds would have a cigarette and a Mars bar and they'd be good to go. I was having ice baths in my compression tights with, you know, foam rolling every night, you know. So, I definitely felt it, you know, I could feel my energy levels depleting rather more than the 18, 19 year olds did, but you know, passed everything. So got around it, and yeah, next thing you know, I'm jumping out of aircraft and being a company commander in a parachute battalion, which was absolutely fantastic.
I have so much respect for you for doing that. I mean, competing against these, what we can call them kids, because they are kids at the end of the day. And you did that at the age of 33. I mean, Alex and I are a little bit older than that, and I don't think I could do that, try and compete with kids at the age of 19. So respect.
I'll watch you gin and tonic.
Yeah.
Oh, we can outdrink them. We can outdrink them, but outrunning and outpacing, forget it. I'm gone. I'm like an old person.
Yeah, but you know, I was also 6 years into my military career, and you do develop a kind of mental toughness from, you know, a bit of mental resilience, and a lot of that course is mental, where you just keep going. Even when you're tired.
That's what
and hurting.
You knew when you took it on, right? You knew it was going to be like that. You were mentally ready to be absolutely bollocksed.
Yeah, and I was well prepared. You know, I was my brigade deputy commander, Andy Jackson, was an absolutely brilliant bloke. And he, you know, he made sure that I was in a good place before I went. You know, he got me to do a 2-miler with him, and I beat him. So he was like, he was happy that I could pass B Company if I could beat him. He was like, yeah, that's good enough for me. So, you know, I think it's a theme in your army career, is that you don't often go to things like that where you're not prepared, because generally people are good and look after look after people they know that are going forward for such things. So, you know, if I've had, you know, when I've been a commander, I've had lads going into selection, I've made sure they've had the time to train. You know, the army is good at looking after people. It gets slated a lot. And I think the negativity gets amplified and the positivity gets overlooked. But, you know, the army does lots of things that I would have changed, but they also do loads of stuff really well. And I don't think that's emphasized enough.
Let's talk about, you talk about mental toughness and you talk about this kind of suck it up attitude. You challenged that a bit about a year ago and you really got hammered for it, didn't you?
Yeah, a little bit. It was all fairly blown out of proportion in some ways, but it was a very unpleasant experience to go through.
On Twitter? So, you know, never.
It's idyllic place, Twitter, you know. Everybody loves each other, holds hands, gives each other flowers and sings songs, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, the context was I was in a really rough place anyway. So I was pretty much falling apart at the seams before it even happened, because it was the 10th anniversary of the Afghan who died on pretty much as I was trying to help him out. And you know, I'd had not a very good New Year's Eve on the 10th anniversary of that, where I kind of woke up at 6 in the morning with a kind of empty bottle of whiskey and kind of a load of Christmas presents that I'd stacked up that I'd then fallen over and passed out. And, you know, I was in the midst of being permanently downgraded at work. And then my dog died, so literally the day before. So I was in a really bad place about that. And then the context is my girlfriend at the time had, she'd been a fighter, you know, professional MMA fighter. And so I'd taken a fairly deep interest in head injury because it was starting to be talked about quite often in the papers. And, you know, you get footballers from the 60s and 70s who are getting really early dementia problems from heading the football. You know, there's currently a case against the Rugby Football Union by a bunch of rugby players who, you know, I think it's Jason Lennon. I can't remember which player it is, but he said he can't remember winning the World Cup in 2003. It might be Woodcock, actually. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But the point is that these repetitive head injuries are now proven to cause really long-term lasting damage. You know, the kind of most famous one being the Hernandez documentary on Netflix about the American footballer whose brain was effectively Swiss cheese when they did an autopsy on him. And the P Company training staff posted a video of milling, which is where you stand toe-to-toe with somebody else, punch them in the face for 60 seconds to see if they can take it and see if you can take it. And I suggested that perhaps in the light of recent medical evidence, it wasn't a great idea anymore, and we should probably leave it behind in the 1940s. And that went nuclear for some reason. People took it really personally, as if I'd somehow taken a turd on regimental tradition. Perhaps all I was saying was that if our soldiers' brains are their greatest asset, then perhaps we should find another way to test that resilience. And I pretty much stand by that, because all the evidence that comes out in drips and drabs now is supportive of the fact that even subconcussive head impact can cause mental damage. So they had an experiment where they had ballers heading a football for 10 minutes. Now, modern footballs aren't a patch on what they used to be in the 50s and 60s. They're not leather anymore. They don't get soaked wet and become heavy. But even 10 minutes of just heading a football, these footballers showed cognitive decline. And that's not even a concussive blow. Whereas if you're getting punched in the face for 60 seconds, that can't be a good thing. And I've since been contacted by people who said they've had, you know, bleeds on the brain after it. And I don't think it's many people. And I think the risk is relatively low. But I was hoping to start a discussion about head injuries and mental illness, but it just turned into this Twitter shitstorm. Which I didn't, and because I wasn't in a great place, I could have escalated it myself by telling people to, or basically just putting out a tweet saying, "Right, you can all fuck off, I don't care." and then that made it into the Daily Mail, and then hours of fun were had. So yeah, it was all a bit of a shit show. But I stand by my basic premise and my basic point, which was that head injuries are bad. We should probably avoid deliberately having head impact for our soldiers where we possibly can. And that's from a place of actually caring about soldiers rather than trying to be utterly disrespectful to however many years of regimental history.
It's not just head injuries, though, is it? I mean, it's so romanticised, the idea of parachute troops now, because of Band of Brothers and things like that. But there are severe implications for paratroopers in later years, aren't there?
Well, there can be. I mean, you know, the army is physical generally. You know, I've always been a bit injury prone, and you know, the worst injury I've had was a slip disc from a parachute jump, but that was kind of my own fault because I made an arse of my landing, quite literally by landing on my arse, which is absolutely not the recommended method. And yeah, you know, you do get dodgy knees and dodgy backs, and but that's kind of common to most people who've been in the infantry, I'd imagine. I don't think it's necessarily specifically parachuting, because I think, you know, parachuting is a useful capability. Sign up to put your body, you know, right to and including chance you might get killed if you go on operations. And so, you know, there has to be an element of accepting that things are going to take their toll on you, because the human body's not designed to put a 60-pound pack on and kind of run up and down mountains. You know, you're going to have dramas with that. And I did see an article on the Wavell Room recently, I think it was a repost from 2017, where they made the point that, you know, a lot of injuries happen to soldiers because of these kind of attritional bits of fizz that we do, and that's something that we should minimize as well. But you know, my sort of corollary to that was, if we're going to minimize attritional injuries to joints, we should probably try and minimize attritional injuries to the brain as well.
I'm just going to throw in something personal here. Actually, Andrew knows this already, and Alex does, but my uncle's a former paratrooper. Oh, God, I can't even speak today. And he's in his 60s. God forbid he's listening to this, and he's going to go, stop revealing my age to people. he's in his 60s, former medic, American forces. And I'm sorry to say, but he is practically falling apart. I mean, he's a medic. So not only is he carrying his own pack and everything else, but on top of that, medical equipment. As many of his friends, you know, they're having to get spinal fusions and neck fusions and hip replacements and knee replacements and everything else. These men are sacrificing so much, you know, for freedom, for the army. And then in a later age, they're sacrificing their bodies. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, I'd do it again. You know, I think it was worth it. You know, I've had a couple of ankle reconstructions. And I've had a hernia surgery and I've had a slip disc, but you know, that bit.
It's like if you ask an astronaut, isn't it? Your bones are going to look like an 80-year-old, but you get to go into space. They'll do it.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Some of the best moments of my life. You know, I've jumped out of Black Hawks over the Middle East doing free fall. I've jumped out of Chinooks over in Fort Bragg, and I've did the 82nd Airborne's divisional jump when we were out there. And you know, that stuff I'll remember for the rest of my life, and you know, something that was really cool, and I'd earned my place to be there, so it was quite special, and I was in command at the time, so it had a double significance. And you know, when I'm 70 or sat in my rocking chair, that's the kind of stuff I'll remember. And if I've got a bit of a sore back, then you know, I'll probably still think that it was worth it.
It's something that I really want to do, is jump out of a plane, but there's only one condition that I do it. Which means I have to fly to America, and my uncle has to, obviously can't jump out of a plane now, but he has to go with me, and I want him there on the ground, because I think that's such a intimate bonding thing between the two of us, where I get to experience it with him, even though however much I'd love to be able to do it with him, like physically, I can't. But for me, I think that would be an awesome experience.
No, I totally get that. And, you know, my dad's, and we both served. My dad's retired like 2 weeks ago at the age of 70 as an RAF reservist, but he had a full-time career as a helicopter pilot in the Navy and the Air Force before he kind of left full-time service to be a reservist. And, you know, we wear our uniform together if we have the opportunity in the past, because it is a nice thing that brings you together. You know, my grandfather was US Army as well. And I always took great pride in wearing my American rings and my combat infantry badge to sort of in his memory. So, yeah, you know, these things are really lovely. I reckon that's something you should do. 100%. Get it done. No excuses now. You've promised it on tape.
Oh, dear. Alex, are you coming with me?
Fuck it. Why not? Andrew, what's next for you?
So I'm looking, trying to get my job at Sandhurst made full-time, which would be awesome. I really enjoy it. And actually, you know, it's a great way to kind of have a connection to the military and use some of my experience whilst using the academic knowledge that I'm now accruing as a PhD. So that's the plan at the moment. Oh, and I'm also volunteering to be an army cadet instructor, because I quite like to give a bit back if I possibly could. So, and that seems like a really good way to do it. Because I started off in the cadets. I think they probably put me on the path to where I am today. So, you know, if I could give a bit back that way, then that'd be awesome.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. I love this. I think it's been absolutely amazing listening to your experiences, and especially being able to openly talk about PTSD, because that is so important to be able to try and help anyone who is listening right now, who is struggling and who is having any problems resolving from PTSD or physical or anything, please get in contact with an appropriate charity. Andrew, what would you recommend? Where would you recommend these people go?
Well, in a crisis, the Samaritans are a really good place to start, because although it's just someone at the other end of the phone to listen to you, you know, sometimes just talking about it can be enough to take the edge off, you know, a really, really dark day where you might then go on and do something awful if you keep internalizing it. So talk about it is the first thing to do. Combat stress are pretty good, but if you're in the military, I would say just put your hand up and go to the regimental medical officer. They don't ask you any questions. They'll refer you straight away to the mental health team, and then you can really get the proper help you need. And I would say that the Army DCMH, the mental health team, are incredible. Like, you know, I do wonder if I would have been here today still if I hadn't had the help I'd received from them, and they're absolute angels. And I can't stress how much and how supportive that they are. The treatment you get is first rate, and they will look after you. So, but it's all about taking that first step and recognizing that something's wrong. And that's often the hardest part, because you're walking around angry, you're walking around, you know, built up tension and nightmares and feeling hopelessness. And there's probably almost certainly some kind of alcohol abuse or gambling or sex, you know, addiction or something like that in there as well. And you just don't realize that these are all symptoms of something deeper. So identifying that something's wrong and asking for help is the first, most hardest and most important step. And if you are able to do that, then the help that you need is there. And that's the bit that I would just kind of drumbeat till my dying breath, because it's so important to try and make sure that people who need help get it.
I would chuck in Veterans in Action as well, because it's run by veterans with PTSD. They're only little, but they're like, they will go and knock on someone's door every day if they've got the capability of, if someone needs help, and to make sure they're all right. So them too.
Cool. Great stuff.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. No, I've really enjoyed it. It's been good. And thank you for listening to me chops off for the best part of an hour. I appreciate that. And I've since been contacted by people who said they've had, you know, bleeds on the brain after it. I don't think it's many people. I think the risk is relatively low. But I was hoping to start a discussion about head injuries and mental illness, but it just turned into this Twitter shitstorm. Which I didn't, and because I wasn't in a great place, I could have escalated it myself by telling people to, or basically just putting out a tweet saying, "Right, you can fuck off, I don't care." and then that made it into the Daily Mail, and then hours of fun were had. So yeah, it was all a bit of a shit show. But I stand by my basic premise and my basic point, which was that head injuries are bad. We should probably avoid deliberately having head impact for our soldiers where we possibly can. And that's from a place of actually caring about soldiers rather than trying to be utterly disrespectful to however many years of regimental history.
It's not just head injuries though, is it? I mean, it's so romanticized, the idea of parachute troops now, because of Band of Brothers and things like that. But there are severe implications for paratroopers in later years, aren't there?
Well, there can be. I mean, you know, the army is physical generally. You know, I've always been a bit injury prone, and you know, the worst injury I've had was a slip disc from a parachute jump, but that was kind of my own fault, because I made an arse of my landing, quite literally, by landing on my arse, which is absolutely not the recommended method. And yeah, you know, you do get dodgy knees and dodgy backs, but that's kind of common to most people who've been in the infantry, I'd imagine. I don't think it's necessarily specifically parachuting, because I think, you know, parachuting is a useful capability. Sign up to put your body, you know, right to land, including chance you might get killed if you go on operations. And so, you know, there has to be an element of accepting that things are going to take their toll on you, because the human body's not designed to put a 60-pound pack on and kind of run up and down mountains. You know, you're going to have dramas with that. And I did see an article on the Wavell Room recently. I think it was a repost from 2017, where they made the point that, you know, a lot of injuries happen to soldiers because of these kind of attritional bits of fizz that we do. And that's something that we should minimise as well. But, you know, my sort of corollary to that was, if we're going to minimise attritional injuries to joints, we should probably try and minimise attritional injuries to the brain as well.
I'm just going to throw in something personal here. Actually, Andrew knows this already, and Alex does, but my uncle's a former paratrooper. Paratrooper. Oh, God, I can't even speak today. And he's in his 60s. God forbid he's listening to this, and he's going to go, stop revealing my age to people. he's in his 60s, former medic, American forces. And I'm sorry to say, but he is practically falling apart. I mean, he's a medic. So not only is he carrying his own pack and everything else, but on top of that, medical equipment, as many of his friends, you know, they're having to get spinal fusions and neck fusions and hip replacements and knee replacements and everything else. These men are sacrificing so much, you know, for freedom, for the army, and then in a later age they're sacrificing their bodies. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, I'd do it again. You know, I think it was worth it. You know, I've had a couple of ankle reconstructions, and I've had a hernia surgery and I've had a slip disc, but you know, that bit,
it's like if you ask an astronaut, isn't it, your bones are going to look like an 80-year-old, but you get to go into space, they'll do it.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Some of the best moments of my life, you know, I've jumped out of Blackhawks over the Middle East doing free fall. I've jumped out of Chinooks over in Fort Bragg, and I did the 82nd Airborne's divisional jump when we were out there. And, you know, that stuff I'll remember for the rest of my life, and, you know, something that was really cool. And I'd earned my place to be there, so it was quite special. And I was in command at the time, so it had a double significance. And you know, when I'm 70 or sat in my rocking chair, that's the kind of stuff I'll remember. And if I've got a bit of a sore back, then, you know, I'll probably still think that it was worth it.
It's something that I really want to do, is jump out of a plane. But there's only one condition that I do it, which means I have to fly to America. And my uncle has to, obviously can't jump out of a plane now, but he has to go with me. And I want him there on the ground, because I think that's such a intimate bonding thing between the two of us. I get to experience it with him, even though however much I'd love to be able to do it with him, like physically, I can't. But for me, I think that would be an awesome experience.
No, I totally get that. And, you know, my dad and I, we both served. My dad's retired like 2 weeks ago at the age of 70 as an RAF reservist, but he had a full-time career as a helicopter pilot in the Navy and the Air Force before he kind of left full-time service to be a reservist. And, you know, we wear our uniform together if we have the opportunity in the past, because it is a nice thing that brings you together. You know, my grandfather was US Army as well, and I always took great pride in wearing my American rings and my combat infantryman's badge to sort of fit in his memory. So, yeah, you know, these things are really lovely. I reckon that's something you should do. 100% get it done. No excuses now, you've promised it on tape.
Oh dear. Alex, are you coming with me?
Fuck it, why not? Andrew, what's next for you?
So I'm looking, trying to get my job at Sandhurst made full-time, which would be awesome. I really enjoy it. And actually, you know, it's a great way to kind of have a connection to the military and use some of my experience whilst using the academic knowledge that I'm now accruing as a PhD. So that's the plan at the moment. Oh, and I'm also volunteering to be an Army cadet instructor, because I quite like to give a bit back if I possibly could. So, and that seems like a really good way to do it, because I started off in the cadets. I think they probably put me on the path to where I am today. So, you know, if I could give a bit back that way, then that'd be awesome.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. I love this. I think it's been absolutely amazing listening to your experiences, and especially being able to openly talk about PTSD, because that is so important to be able to try and help anyone who is listening right now, who is struggling and who is having any problems resolving from PTSD or physical or anything. Please get in contact with an appropriate charity. Andrew, what would you recommend? Where would you recommend these people go?
Well, in a crisis, the Samaritans are a really good place to start, because although it's just someone at the other end of the phone to listen to you, you know, sometimes just talking about it can be enough to take the edge off, you know, a really, really dark day where you might then go on and do something awful if you keep internalizing it. So talk about it is the first thing to do. Combat stress are pretty good. But if you're in the military, I would say just put your hand up and go to the the regimental medical officer. They don't ask you any questions. They'll refer you straight away to the mental health team. And then you can really get the proper help you need. And I would say that the Army DCMH, the mental health team, are incredible. Like, you know, I do wonder if I would have been here today still if I hadn't had the help I'd received from them. And they're absolute angels. And I can't stress how much and how supportive that they are. The treatment you get is first rate. And they will look after you. So, but it's all about taking that first step and recognizing that something's wrong. And that's often the hardest part, because you're walking around angry. You're walking around, you know, with built up tension and nightmares and feeling hopelessness. And there's probably almost certainly some kind of alcohol abuse or gambling or sex, you know, addiction or something like that in there as well. And you just don't realize that these are all symptoms of something deeper. So identifying that something's wrong, asking for help, is the first, most hardest and most important step. And if you are able to do that, then the help that you need is there. And that's the bit that I would just kind of drumbeat till my dying breath, because it's so important to try and make sure that people who need help get it.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. No, I've really enjoyed it. It's been good. And thank you for listening to me chops off for the best part of an hour. I appreciate that.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels, because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you could be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hack history, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.